From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd.
Millions of Americans are armed to protect the Constitution of the United States against enemies foreign and domestic.
USA! USA! Sounds from the January 6th insurrection in Washington, D.C., recorded by the New Yorker magazine. Supporters of Donald Trump demanding he be declared winner of the 2020 presidential election, which he lost. It's not the first time this century questions about an American presidential election have been raised, but certainly the most violent reaction over the results, with several people dying. Around the world, the legitimacy of democracy is being called into question. Can faith be restored in rule of the people? Stanford professor James Fishkin has been studying democracy and how to improve it for more than three decades. He is the Janet M. Peck Chair in International Communications in the School of Humanities and Sciences and Director of the Center of Deliberative Democracy. And he has written Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. He joins us now. Professor, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, you know, agree with them or not, those protesters, the sounds of the people calling into question the rules of our democracy and how we pick our leaders, seems like we're in pretty big trouble in the country.
Well, we have very deep divisions, extreme polarization by party. The tribalism has gotten out of control. We have social media, which feeds not only information, but misinformation and disinformation. And many people are in their own filter bubbles, never hearing the other side. And so it's very hard for people to sort through the facts. And our shared public sphere, you know, when people offer arguments and then they're responded to, and the whole process with the competition of ideas sort of sorts out a collective view. All of that is broken down because we have so much freedom to find exactly the media sources that we'd like, that we will tend to agree with and find congenial, and to avoid the viewpoints we think we disagree with. And then there are the bad actors who are actually trying to manipulate public opinion, not only in the conventional sense of making a persuasive case, but in the sense of offering complete fabricated disinformation. And so it's no wonder that people get disoriented. And then we tend to listen to the loud voices and the mobilizable voices, and we don't understand how many people across the political spectrum are actually interested in solving the public's problems. So yes, democracy is in trouble, and our technology has inadvertently facilitated that.
You know, right after the Second World War, it appeared that democracy really was on the march around the globe. Dictators falling, these constitutional assemblies being organized, following America's lead, really. But lately, even in this country, democracy we know is slow and it's messy, and we have gridlock from time to time. That has a lot of people seeming to look at these authoritarian ideas of rule, places like Singapore and China.
Yes. In fact, I think that the approval ratings for democratic institutions all around the world are at vanishingly low levels, because a political system gets its legitimacy either because of the process or because of the results. And in a lot of places, democracies are leading to deadlock. And deadlock means you're not able to get anything done. And the autocratic regimes are able to get things done. Of course, they are also often filled with corruption and filled with just maintenance of power. But I think the real competition for democracy is not the most authoritarian regimes. It's a kind of benign authoritarianism. Singapore is a good example. Mm-hmm. They have extremely competent administration who do the cost-benefit analysis to try to solve public policy problems. But they are disconnected from the people because they're not responsive to the people. It's not what we would call a democracy. but they do get things done. The Chinese are, it is an autocracy, but they have this idea that they are moving towards a meritocratic system where the people who are really qualified will make the decisions. Now, I don't think China is actually working that way, but it could. And if China adopts something like the Singapore model, which they have talked about, they would be a stronger competitor. But our democracies are competitive, party-based democracies are crippled by the fact, or I don't want to say crippled, they are limited by the fact that competing parties don't want to win the argument, they want to win the election. And so more and more, they will do whatever they can to win the election. And this winning at all costs means that they will disseminate falsehoods. They will use attack ads, campaign advertising. They've always used campaign advertising, but there are certain limitations in the norms of what candidates would do, parties would do in the past. Mm-hmm. But now the important thing seems to be to maintain your position in office. And ironically, well-motivated reforms, like the progressive reforms, primaries, referendums, recalls, to make the office holders more responsive, have had the unexpected effect that everybody in Washington who's in the Congress is afraid of getting primaried, because the people who turn out in the primaries are the people who feel most strongly in their low turnout elections. So that means everybody is beholden to the most extreme portion of their party, whether it's on the right or on the left, whether it's Republican or Democrat, everybody's afraid of being primaried. So they don't want to have the experience of Eric Cantor, who was one of the top Republican Party leaders some years back, who was primaried in a small turnout election in Virginia. So he was out of office forever and became, I'm sure, became a lobbyist, I think.
Yeah.
The point is the fear of the extremes has been, the power of the extremes has been increased in terms of keeping people in line. So there are two ways in which members of Congress have to toe the party line. One is each party has a whip that keeps them in line, but the other is the threat of the people through the primary process. It's not all the people, it's just the people who are willing to turn out in the primary, who are those who feel most strongly. So I think the Democratic reforms have had, while noble in aspiration, have had some unexpected effects.
And now it seems that some of the reforms, I put that in quotes, that we're hearing about, that state legislatures seem to be working on, seem to amount to what at least some call voter suppression. You've got this discussions about we've had gerrymandering, discussions about changing judicial elections. In Arizona, they're talking about allowing state lawmakers to ignore the results, for example, of presidential elections, and then let the state lawmakers decide who gets the state's electoral votes. So this kind of discussion about voter fraud seemed to be animating a lot of what we're hearing lately.
I think some of the reforms in some of the states are terrible ideas, because in order for democracy to work, it has to maintain legitimacy in the public view. And to the extent that anybody can win through voter suppression, they're not being responsive to the people. They're just manipulating their electorate. And there's a long and sad history of voter suppression in the United States, which we've tried over the decades to make some progress on. But this would be these would be retrograde steps. Voter suppression is a bane on democracy. And there are too many, and to the extent that it's a response to the myth of a supposedly stolen election, there are office holders who should be held responsible for spreading a concern that doesn't exist and then offering an antidote that is overkill because it would take away the effective right to vote of millions of people. So I share your concern.
Now, Professor, you remain a firm believer in democracy as a form of government, but you argue that, I didn't realize this, there are four types of democracy, and the success of a democracy really depends upon the type that's practiced and supported. So let's go through them. First, you talk about competitive democracy. Explain that to us.
Well, that's the form of democracy that is most widespread around the world. And it's a democracy of competing parties. Both the merit of that and the difficulty is that the parties compete and the winners take office. And there was a theorist of democracy named Joseph Schumpeter at Harvard who said, democracy, don't think about the will of the people, just think about democracy as the competitive struggle for the people, for the people's vote. So there are competing teams. One of them takes office because they got the most votes, so they won the election, the other's out. But the one that's out knows that there will be a future election when they have a chance to get back in. But he says there's a limitation to that model of democracy, which is that the parties will do whatever they can to shape public opinion in order to win the election. That is, just as competing firms in the marketplace advertise to get their business and will shape the preferences, we have to realize that the so-called will of the people that results from a competitive election is to some considerable degree shaped by advertising, indoctrination, propaganda, etc. My view of that is that you can have competitive democracy, but you don't have to have the winners win because of propaganda and manipulation. You can have office holders who will in fact be interested in listening to the merits of the argument, but you have to incentivize them for that in order to do what the public really thinks should be done. So you need an entry point for what I call deliberative democracy, which I'll describe in due course. But competitive democracy is what we've got. To the extent anybody's got a democracy, it's almost always a competitive democracy. And indeed, when you have less competition, there's a problem, because if you don't have competition, then the people don't even have a choice. Mm-hmm. But if they have a choice and they don't have all the information or attention, or they don't have any incentive to get good information, you will not have an informed choice.
So that's one form. Then there's also elite democracy. How is that different?
It's elite deliberation. People don't realize this, but our system was born when Madison thought about how to design a republic. He didn't even dare use the word democracy, because mm-hmm. democracy was thought to be a form of mob rule. After all, the people had killed Socrates, and in those days, any large-scale nation state was mostly governed by a king. So nobody knew whether you could get a republic at the vast scale of the American colonies. I think there were 3.5 or 4 million people at the time. So he thought of this idea of, he called it successive filtration. That is, the people would select the members of the state legislatures. The state legislators would select the members of the Electoral College. The people would select the convention that came up with the new constitution. The people would select the state legislatures. The state legislatures would select the senators. And so the senators were not directly elected by the people in the original constitution. They were elected by the state legislatures. So he thought with this successive filtration from one level to the next, you'd get the best people. So therefore, the Electoral College was not a way of counting the votes of the people. The Electoral College was a mechanism for selecting the most qualified person to be president. The Senate was not supposed to be divided by party. Madison didn't even think of parties at that point, although later he went off to co-found a political party. But at that time, he didn't think of parties. He thought of the individual senators would just make decisions on the merits, and they would, quote, refine and enlarge the public views by passing them through the medium of a chosen body of citizens, as he said in Federalist 10. They were supposed to think for themselves about the merits and come to a deliberative thoughtful conclusion about what was best. And that was after discussion with each other. And so that was the elite deliberation model. And then it gradually changed, began to change even in the fight over the original Constitution. Then direct democracy became more and more prominent in America with the progressives. And I live in the state of California, where in 1911 or so, we began to have primaries, referendums, even recall elections. We may even have another recall election soon. So in the primaries, referendum, and recall, that was the battle cry of the progressives, taking the votes directly to the people. But the trouble is, if you've got a large, it's one thing to take the decision directly to the people if you have a New England town meeting.
Yeah.
But it's another thing to take the decision directly to the people if you've got a state of millions of people. Yeah. In California, we've got the biggest state. Yeah. So what are you going to do with whatever it is, 40 million people? How are you going to reach them? Well, you reach them in the same way you do any other political campaign, through television, internet, and other media. And then you get these negative soundbite campaigns. So you don't give the people a lot to think about. And besides, most people then are subject to what social scientists have called rational ignorance. If I've got one vote in millions, why should I pay a lot of attention to the complexities of public policy? Because my individual vote or opinion won't have much effect. But if we don't have people, we don't have the citizens, the voters, thinking about what should be done, who's going to think about it? Yeah. The representatives just want to get reelected, and the voters aren't thinking because they've got too many other things to do, quite rightly. They've got to look after their families and their jobs and the rest. So any complicated question, they're going to not know a great deal or be incentivized to have a lot of opinion about.
Yeah, this deliberative democracy. Tell me how this works, because it's a fascinating idea, but it seems the difficulty of democracy is that people nowadays don't seem to take the necessary time to become informed, because the key thing in what you're describing is to bring reason and discussion back into participating in this process. So how does this work?
Well, I had a very simple idea. And I thought it was my idea, but I found out it actually went back to ancient Athens, because the Athenians used it. You take a random sample of the population and you bring them together to deliberate in depth. So instead of one vote in millions, in a project we did called America in One Room, each participant had one vote or one voice in 500 and one voice in small groups for small group discussions of 12 or 15. So each person could think that his or her voice mattered. It mattered in the discussions and it mattered in the results. So I think that we incentivize the people to get involved and we make it easy for them to understand the issues. So we have balanced briefing materials on the issues that are vetted by an advisory group of people on either side of the issue. We have an initial questionnaire where we recruit the people. Like any other poll, the method I use, I call deliberative polling. So we have a poll, and then we bring the people together, either physically or online. In fact, we've done 110 of these things around the world in more than 30 countries. I think it's 32 right now. And in each case, we take a microcosm of the country, a scientifically based microcosm, that is a really good sample that's brought together. If it's face-to-face, we transport the people, we pay all their expenses, we have media partners. The New York Times actually published the pictures of all of the participants in America in One Room, and that made them feel important enough to spend all the time and effort. We also paid their expenses and had a modest honorarium, but they were just delighted to do it.
I'm curious, when you do this, the question that I think people would have is, how do you make sure in the selection of the folks who are gathered that you have the proper sample? You're an expert at polling and identifying the necessary people. How do you do that, number one? And number two, how do you make sure that you don't pick the topics, they pick the topics?
Well, We have an advisory group on the issues. Every one of these things has to be about something.
Okay.
So whether it's healthcare or immigration or the economic issues and tax proposals or international relations. We had five big issues in America in one room, and we had a very distinguished advisory group that vetted the materials, but we took policy proposals that were part of the, that were in the political discourse, part of the campaign, and then the advisory group had to vet the materials for the pros and cons, the arguments for and against each of the proposals, vet them for balance and for accuracy. And then we also had a video version of the briefing materials, so that people who were less literate wouldn't have any problem understanding them. But everything was scrupulously balanced and made public, and it's still public. You can see it on the Center for Deliberative Democracy website. So we had those proposals in, we had five issues in America in One Room, 49 questions, 49 policies, I believe. But a lot of them were variations on the same thing, so people could discuss them together. So then we gathered them and gathered the people, and in small groups, they'd spend an hour and a half on one topic, like healthcare or immigration. And then they'd go to a plenary session where the questions from all the groups about the healthcare, about that topic, would be posed by them to competing experts who would answer from different points of view. So we've done this all over the world, because then people have the small groups, the plenaries, the small groups of plenaries, they alternate that for a weekend, and then at the end they take the same questionnaires as when they were first contacted. So how do we make the sample representative? The same way that any good scientific public opinion poll would. You don't volunteer yourself. You're rather selected in stratified random sampling to be representative of the population. And you know, the science of public opinion has come a long way in terms of being able to get a good sample if you have a reasonable response rate and if you have, so the real challenge for us is we can get the first sample, but then after they take the survey, we invite them and we have to get those people to come. And we have a very good track record of getting the people who take the initial survey to come. In American One Room and a lot of other projects, we have a control group, a separate sample that is never invited. They just take the survey before and after. And very often they don't change their opinions at all, or if they do change, it's because of stuff going on in the media. But our sample really changes dramatically. So in American One Room, the percentage Republicans who wanted to send the undocumented immigrants back to their home countries, so-called, dropped by 40 points. It was 40 points, whether it was 80 to you know, almost 80 points to 40%. That's an earthquake in public opinion.
The ideas that you're talking about, deliberative democracy, these are not untested ideas. You've used these all over the place. In particular, I was amazed to hear that you used this successfully in Bulgaria. Can you explain that?
That was the second national project that we did in Bulgaria. And at that point, we helped with our Bulgarian partners convene a national random sample of the people in this great hall of the people that was left over from the Soviet days. And it was about the condition of the Roma and about the Roma's Roma in education, in housing. And one of the striking things that came out of it was the percentage of the people in Bulgaria who were willing to support closing the Roma-only schools and busing the children to schools with everybody else went from, I think it was 40% to 64%. And that was support for busing and for having the Roma children in schools with everybody else in the Bulgarian language rather than the Roma language. Those Roma schools, even the Roma in the sample, did not want their children to continue in those schools because the schools didn't even have teachers. The older children were supposed to teach the younger children, and it was in the Roma language. So those schools did not prepare the Roma children for employment. There was also support for changing the housing, allowing them ways of providing housing for them outside the so-called ghettos where they were living. And the antipathy to the Roma was very, very strong in Bulgaria. And one of the things I'm proudest of is that our Bulgarian partners give us a lot of credit for catalyzing the change, because the Roma schools are now desegregated. The Roma-only schools are gone. And of course, there's some, you know, segregation in terms of where people live and that sort of thing. But it's not official segregation, and it's largely desegregated. And this dramatized the way in which, when people deliberate together, they open themselves up to arguments and perspectives which they would never otherwise consider if they were just looking at it on television, or hearing something on the radio or in the media. That is, they realize that these policies affect real people who have families, who have children, and the voices of those people come to have an impact on their views. And so this is one of many dramatic changes. We've also worked in Northern Ireland, you know, with Protestants and Catholics, and We've dealt with deliberative polling for contested policy issues in a lot of places where it arguably over the long term has had an effect in terms of showing that certain policies are possible.
You know, what I'm hearing you say is that the proper use of deliberative polling and deliberative democracy really results in improving social cohesion among various groups within on a large society. Is that right?
Yes, social cohesion and mutual understanding, because realizing that other people in the society have comparable interests and they're worth listening to. And now, of course, that doesn't mean everybody's worth listening to, but by and large, most people are worth listening to, and most people have opinions or can develop opinions about their interests. We've done deliberative polling all over the world, even in areas where the population was almost entirely illiterate. We've done this in rural Uganda in a remote region called Mount Elgon, where we had an effect on the education of girls and women. There weren't schools for the girls to go to that were close enough to the villages where they could go to them without walking for hours and being molested on the way back and forth. So the families were keeping the girls at home, and they weren't getting any education. And so what kind of future could they have? And so we had a big effect in Uganda on that issue. And in Ghana, we had an impact on water, sanitation, public health issues. So it seems to me that people all over the world ought to be consulted to get buy-in, to get public buy-in on contested policies. One of the most exciting things that's happened with deliberative polling is that in Mongolia, of all places, we've been working in Mongolia, which is a competitive democracy caught between Russia on the one hand and China on the other. You might think it's a small country, but in fact, it's a very large country. It's the same size as Western Europe physically. And we did a project in for the mayor with Ulaanbaatar, where he implemented all the results, but was very surprised about, it was about what infrastructure projects to build that they had already consulted the public about. And the mayor thought, well, the public would probably want this subway system, a metro system that the Japanese had offered to lend the city the money for. But no, what the people really wanted is, because Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar is the coldest major city in the world, and the children were not getting appropriate, were triple teamed on the schools because the schools didn't have proper heating and insulation. They wanted proper heating and insulation for all the schools, and that's what they got. That was their top priority out of 14 or so projects. This is all of this, everything I've been saying is described in the book. So that was so successful that Mongolia then passed a law requiring deliberative polling before they can change the constitution. And that law has passed, and we convened a large national deliberative poll in Mongolia on the steps of the government palace, which has a big statue of Genghis Khan overlooking the, and under that are the nearly 700 people in a photo that we took where I'm in the photo. I wasn't a member of the sample, but the rest were. And those nearly 700 people, I think it was 695 or something like that, deliberated for an entire weekend and produced a recommendation for an amendment. And the parliament has now passed the amendment, changing the constitution. And so there are a lot of cases like that where the actual deliberations of the people are part of a process. When Japan had the Fukushima disaster, they commissioned the deliberative poll to advise the government about which of three plans involving nuclear power or not involving nuclear power with different mixes of nuclear power and fossil fuels and renewable energy, which of them to adopt. And the government at the time accepted the preferences of the deliberative poll at the end of the day. And that was an official input into policy. So one of the things that we're doing is finding ways, whether it's in Texas or it's in Mongolia or it's in Japan, or where the deliberations of the people can be made consequential for some difficult policy issue. And that, I think, is a route to the possible reforming of democracy, where the issues will really weigh with the people. I'll give you one last example. In Japan, they were going to change their pension system. They were going to privatize it. And in the conventional polls, almost 70% of the public thought the idea was a good idea to have private accounts and get rid of the government pension, what we would call Social Security, because Japan is getting very, very old. But when the people deliberated about it in a deliberative poll, the 69 or 70% fell to something like 26%, because the people didn't want the risk of having to invest their pensions in the stock market. They wanted something firm, so they moved overwhelmingly to prefer a rise in the taxes. That is the consumption tax, a kind of national sales tax. They wanted to pay taxes to make the pension system viable and to have something guaranteed. And that's what the government ended up doing. So you see, if the government, a bunch of technocrats said, oh, look at Chile, they've got a privatized pension system and they've got these demographic challenges, we should do that. And the government was about to do it, but instead they listened to the people. And now today, we are convening, we've got a deliberative poll in Chile, which is partly on the pension systems, and we'll see. But one of the proposals is to go back to the government guaranteed, the pay-as-you-go pension system, at least in part. And I don't know how that will fare, but you know, that's up to the Chileans. Mm-hmm. But it shows that people should have a stake in what their retirement is going to look like. Good retirement is something people normally don't think ahead about, but it's in their interest too. So we think the way to get legitimacy, democracy is supposed to be connect the will of the people to what's being done. And the way to find out the will of the people is to do deliberative democracy projects the kind that we've been doing, and that the kind that we launched in Texas back in 1996.
Yeah. So for those who might be concerned, the deliberative groups do not take the place of voting. People still vote.
Absolutely. This is just a recommendation convened for certain policy issues that are especially difficult or challenging.
So, and the great fear that I, in reading the book, is that there's this concern that there may be another layer of influencers between voting citizens and the government they elect. But in this case, the influencers are people who have taken a careful look at what the policy options are and should be, as opposed to just fighting over trying to win.
Right. Exactly. And most people who wouldn't get involved, they're part of what makes the sample representative. And they do then think about the issues, become more informed, more respectful of other people they disagree with, and they continue to become more engaged. They're a bit more like ideal citizens, and that's what we need. But people are busy. they're under a lot of pressure, particularly these days. So we're doing a lot of our projects on Zoom or even with a special platform that we have. We're doing a lot of projects. We're doing more and more of these projects virtually because then we can save the cost of transportation, hotels, and the rest of it. And we can make deliberative polling and deliberative democracy a more regular part of our civic life. And we're also bringing it into the schools and engaging civic groups for certain purposes to do deliberation. And we think that the experience of deliberating will make citizens more open to thinking about their policy, regardless of political party, but just in terms of the issue of what should be done to solve these problems. And God knows we have plenty of pressing public problems.
People who hear this idea and may think that it's new, really what it sounds like is you're asking us to go back to more of what James Madison had in mind. I know you have written before that you want to that what's been going on is we've been substituting the whims of the people for the methods of Madison Avenue.
That's right. Madison wanted the representatives to deliberate. He wasn't quite ready to take the Athenian step of the people deliberating. In fact, he didn't actually know about the people deliberating because Aristotle's Constitution of Athens that describes it all wasn't discovered or rediscovered until 100 years later. But so he didn't know about the Athenian case, but he wanted the representatives to deliberate. I want the people to deliberate because the representatives are so have to face the party whips and party discipline. So they may not be free to deliberate, but the people are free to deliberate, and they are capable of offering a considered judgment. And so I say in the book that we've taken a long journey from Madison's vision of somebody deliberating, namely the representatives, to Madison Avenue. And Madison Avenue is, of course, the home of the advertising industry. But I think instead of Madison Avenue, I'm sure Madison would turn over in his grave if he knew that that's the way his name was being used. Because he wanted people to think for themselves.
Oh yeah.
So I think that the one thing I've learned in all these projects around the world, 110 of them in more than 30 countries, is that the people are smart when you give them a chance. And whether they agree or disagree with me is irrelevant. What they do is they have their own reasons for coming to the conclusions that they do, and those are reasons that ought to be listened to by the people who make policy. So we need to figure out the ways of connecting the public's thoughtful views with decisions. And that's the agenda that we're engaged in.
We've been talking about deliberative democracy with James Fishkin, author of Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. At Stanford University, he is the Janet M. Peck Chair in International Communications in the School of Humanities and Sciences, and director of the Center for Deliberative Democracy. Professor, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.